Can I have your attention, please? Est-ce que je peux avoir votre attention, s'il vous plaît? I'd like to present Tim and Cash, who will introduce the video Time to Deliver. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Tim Das, senior writer at Kindari. And as the creators of this film, I just want to say what a privilege it was to be given the opportunity to do our small part in the global fight against AIDS. When the host organization, AIDS 2006, came to us to put together the opening film, they came to us with a theme, Time to Deliver, and I think we mirrored exactly that in the film that we created. It brought a sense of urgency, empowerment, and accountability to hopefully this conference. What we did was create a film set in the future, 25 years in the future, a utopian vision in which many of the world's problems have been solved, and then we sort of revealed that within this utopia, the AIDS pandemic has run amok. Let me just introduce Cash, Claire Cashman. She'll talk about our partners.
Hi, I'm executive producer at Kindari Advertising. This was a huge, huge undertaking for the film industry in Toronto. Everyone banded together to put this together, and we're very, very proud to be involved. Spank Films, Stealing Time, Company X, Technicolor, Gravity, Kodak, we're all involved. So thank you very much, and enjoy the film.
please join me in welcoming Yvonne Chaka Chaka, the princess and music diva from Africa.
Thank you very much. This is on behalf of all those HIV children and women who die of malaria, TB, and HIV. Thank you very much. The song is called Power of Africa. Oh, if you can clap, you can. Because you've been working very hard, and thanks to you.
Good morning and welcome to the closing session of AIDS 2006, the 16th International AIDS Conference.
Bonjour, je suis heureux de vous accueillir à la levée du Congrès SIDA 2006.
It's my pleasure to introduce my co-host, Esther Terrell. Esther currently works as a brilliant health promoter at Women's Health in Women's Hands here in Toronto, a community health center for black women and women of color in the Toronto and surrounding area. She's been involved in the AIDS movement here locally, nationally, and internationally for almost 15 years, and I am delighted that she is my co-host.
And it's my pleasure to introduce my co-host, the lovely Ron Rosnes. He is the vice chair of AIDS 2006 Toronto, local host board of directors. Ron is a former teacher and entrepreneur who has been living with HIV/AIDS for close to 25 years. Since his retirement from work in 1991, he has reinvented himself as a recognized community volunteer, a leader, an advocate for the rights of people living with HIV, through his work with groups such as the AIDS Committee of Toronto, the Canadian Treatment Action Council, the Ontario HIV Treatment Network, the Sherbourne Health Center. Ron has sought to improve access to care, treatment, and support for people living with HIV/AIDS. And I'm very, very delighted to co-host this event with him.
Thank you. As all of us know, a conference on this order of magnitude would not be possible without the generous support of our funders, our donors, and our sponsors. We would like to recognize their generosity.
The Government of Canada.
Province of Ontario.
City of Toronto.
The European Union.
Swedish Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
The Swedish International Development Agency.
Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
GlaxoSmithKline Positive Action.
Mark AIDS Fund.
OPEC Fund for International Development.
Ontario HIV Treatment Network.
Abbott.
Boehringer Ingelheim.
Bristol-Myers Squibb.
Roche.
Gilead.
GlaxoSmithKline.
Pfizer.
Irish Aid.
Royal Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
World Health Organization.
The Australian Government.
Globe and Mail official print media sponsor.
And the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, CBC Radio-Canada, our official host broadcaster. Thank you very much.
And now it's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker for these closing ceremonies. Glenn Murray is a gifted singer-songwriter who plays guitar, harmonica, and piano. He currently performs as a solo artist for a band, Haight Ashbury. In November 2005, Glenn flew to Africa to film a video for his song, Like a Child. It debuted on Much More Music on January 30th, 2006, and is currently number one on Much More Music's Clip Trip show. Please welcome Glenn Murray.
I'd like to dedicate this song to all the men, women, and children around the world who have needlessly suffered, who are now suffering needlessly because of the ignorance and complacency of our global community and its leaders. The song is called Like a Child.
Thank you. just 6 years old, all alone in the world. Child am I, child am I. I lay my brother and sister to sleep, cry alone where we be. Child am I. Where is the world when we cry in the night? Where is the world when our parents die? Where is the world we can save life by reaching out just like a child? Do you close your eyes to the pain in the world? Child cries out, child cries out. One hand reaches out and another joins in. Together we can all begin. Child cries out. Where is the world when we cry in the night? Where is the world when our parents die? Where is the world we can save? Reaching out just like a child. Go now. Do you go to sleep at night, one without a care? Can you go to sleep tonight and know that somewhere a child is all alone, all alone, yeah. Where is the world when we cry in the night? Where is the world when our parents die? Where is the world we can save life? Now reaching out like a child, just like a child, just like a child.
Thank you, Glenn, for that beautiful and heartfelt song. Thank you. What SARS did to tear this city apart, this conference has done to put it back together. And now, our host broadcaster, CBC, has some retrospective moments from the week that ends today.
To assure that promises made are promises kept. We must demand acts over rhetoric and evidence over ideology. It is time to deliver.
It is with great pride that I now declare the 16th International AIDS Conference officially open. Merci beaucoup.
We have to end this disease now. We have to get the drugs to the people who need them. We have to put the funding that's needed into ending AIDS now.
I want you to let the world hear loud and clear that women and girls will no longer be silenced in this pandemic.
We need more political leadership. We need the willingness of leaders to be outspoken on HIV as a leading issue of the day.
HIV has increasingly become a black and brown disease, abroad and domestically.
We have lost an incalculable number of lives which should never have been lost. That's a matter of excruciating pain and unconscionable political neglect. about which historians will one day write.
This is a story that will have a happy ending because of the energy of the people at this event.
This epidemic is 100% preventable.
People will walk away saying that they really did take something home, not only people in the developed world, but also people in the developing world that they can take and use in their own countries.
I just want everybody, especially parents, talk to your children. That's the most important thing, I think, when dealing with HIV/AIDS, is communication. Because without that, kids, we're going to be left in the dark.
There's just been so much loss and so much of it unnecessary. Think about people I knew and people I've worked with, and it's just sad.
Ending AIDS will not be the success of one great scientist, one great community leader, or one great leader. It will be an accomplishment of a whole human family working together for one another.
I light this candle on behalf of all of us who are living with HIV and AIDS.
Karen Tuck, Renee Highway,
Doug Wilson, Liam Pacien.
It's now my great pleasure to bring Mark Wainberg to the podium. Mark, as you know, is the co-chair of this conference and is the director of the McGill University AIDS Center, professor of medicine and of microbiology at McGill, and one of our most recognized scientists internationally. But through the course of this conference, Mark has become a lot more than that to me personally. He's become a friend, and above all, I treasure him as one of our great activists who is bringing the issue in all of its scope to the world. Mark.
Thank you very much, Ron. Dear friends, chers amis. Hasn't it been a fantastic week? On behalf of the entire Toronto local host, I want to say how proud we all are that our time here in Toronto has been such a success. I want to begin by thanking my co-chair, Dr. Helene Gale, and the entire staff of the IAS for their excellent, competent work. I want to pay special thanks to Daryl Perry, the director of the local Toronto host organization, and to Max Unland, the IAS conference director, for a fantastic job. Let me also thank our 2,000 volunteers from both here in Toronto and around the world. They have worked tirelessly to make this conference a success, and thanks also to our many paid staff. We have shown here this week that partnerships that link science, medicine, community, and political activism can translate into action. Many people have also told me that this conference has included groundbreaking science with an enormous amount of information on new drugs and prevention strategies that give hope to the future. Great science and our outstanding global village are an unbeatable combination. Many people have also said that this was one of the best conferences ever at linking the North and the South. I only hope that they were not talking about the long walks that we have subjected you to between the two separate buildings of this conference center. I want to thank as well the many members of the academic community across Canada and abroad, but especially here in Toronto, who have helped to organize this conference. The University of Toronto is a world-class institution that is fully committed to the global battle against HIV and AIDS in each of its many faculties and departments. Thank you for loaning us your faculty members who have provided such high-level leadership. But I also want to remind you all that this conference cannot be deemed a success unless we collectively realize our theme of time to deliver. Indeed, we will have failed unless we dramatically and rapidly expand by millions the numbers of people around the world with access to antiretroviral drugs. Clearly, progress cannot be achieved if more people continue to become infected by HIV each year than the numbers that are able to access treatment. In this context, we also recognize the problem that is sadly posed by HIV denialists. And it is correct that we ask how many additional millions of HIV cases are attributable to the failure of certain world leaders to directly and honestly address issues of HIV/AIDS with their people. In South Africa, as an example, which has more cases of HIV than any country in the world, it is unconscionable that government leaders still do not speak openly about HIV and instead talk about lemon juice as a key prevention strategy. We all know that such talk about lemon juice as a mode of HIV prevention is scientific nonsense. Why don't the government leaders who need to impart critical messages to the vulnerable people of their country also understand this basic fact? Many of you heard my remarks at our opening in which I lamented the absence of the Canadian Prime Minister, Mr. Stephen Harper. It should be noted, however, that the Government of Canada has been extremely generous to this conference, and for this we are grateful. It is also worth mentioning that the type of direct criticism of political leaders that you have heard at this conference might not be as easy to articulate in many countries. I am proud to be a Canadian, and I am proud to live in a mature democracy in which our right to free speech is perhaps our most cherished freedom that empowers our efforts to promote social justice and public health. And it is probably now also safe to assume that the President of Mexico will attend the next International Conference on AIDS. Helene and I hope that you have all enjoyed this wonderful week together with us. Let us leave Toronto with the commitment that we will now work harder than ever. There is no time to waste. It is time to deliver. Thank you. Merci beaucoup.
Our next speaker is a young woman, Keisha Larkin, who is a board member of the Red Road HIV/AIDS Network. She's been living with HIV since 1989 and has dedicated her life to educating Aboriginal communities about HIV/AIDS. Join me in welcoming Keisha Larkin.
Good evening. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional and Indigenous people whose land we reside and visit on, the Mississaugas of the New Credit. I stand here before you today as a mother and a woman living with HIV. In 1988, I contracted HIV through my partner unknowingly. And at that time, AIDS was a death sentence. And this is a grief that I carry with me today as we have lost many of our brothers and sisters to this disease. Today I stand before you with my daughter as a mother. In our tradition of the Kwakwaka'wakw and Piikani people of Canada, traditionally we had what were called rites of passages, when a young woman or man would make the transfer from being a child to an adult. This tradition no longer exists amongst many of our tribes because our culture and our language has been repeatedly challenged and destroyed for the past 500 years. Without acknowledging this, we can't acknowledge where we're going in our future. Our people talk about our future being our children. Our children will be the ones to carry us, to care for us when we are ill. At least this is the way it is supposed to be. I've traveled to many, many communities across Canada and the United States to put a face to HIV, to try and show my people that this does happen to us, and it is happening at epidemic proportions. Although people are reluctant to say that this is an epidemic amongst the First Nations of people, among the First Nations people of Canada, I am here to tell you, yes, it is an epidemic. Very much so alive in our communities. I will no longer be silenced about this truth. And in order for us to acknowledge this, we have to talk about the colonization and cultural genocide of our people. These are very painful topics to talk about. It is hard for me to tell my daughter, who is half Native, of the history of Canada and the Indigenous people of this land. But in order for her to know where she is headed in her future, she has to know where she comes from and what challenges she faces in her life. I've traveled to communities all over Canada. I've been to communities where every community member communicates through a translator to outsiders. These are the Inuit people, these are the Cree people, These are the Dene people. These are the people that are the indigenous people, even to me. And the social conditions that these people are living in are very much like third world countries that are still developing. I've been to communities where there is no running water and you have to walk in order to even get to a health clinic. And I have to acknowledge that our Indigenous people of Canada are the developing people of Canada. The reason why I say this is because I want us to be acknowledged at an international level for the challenges that we face and the complacency that the federal government has for our people on the reserves, the people that this disease is hitting. I am pleading with the international community to please include us in your international discussions and please help us. Because this is an epidemic. It is killing our people. It is affecting our next generations to come, our children and our grandchildren. And we talk about the seven generations. The seventh generation is coming. And how are we going to tell them how we responded to this disease? How are we going to face them and tell them we didn't do enough and there was more that we could do? I'm asking you as a mother to ask yourself this question. I'm asking you to look deep into your hearts, to find a way to help all people living in the world with HIV. One of the challenges that we have in our Aboriginal community, in our Indigenous community in Canada, is we are expected to fit into a non-Indigenous method of thinking, of doing, of believing, and of educating our own people. And I'm here to tell you, it doesn't work. It cannot work. To me, this is a way to further colonize and oppress us. And it's not okay. I don't want to take away from all of the work that our brothers and sisters have on an international level, because we hear your cries, we hear your pleas, and we are with you every step of the way. And we will be in Mexico in 2008. You can count on that. One of the reasons why my daughter is standing here before you today is because her rites of passage has come in the world of AIDS. Her life has been directly affected by HIV. And if I had breast cancer, she would have a lot more support in everyday society. But as it is right now, now I know this seems like a contradiction, but we kind of have to be careful of who we tell and who knows because of the stigma and discrimination that is still attached to having this disease. And I want all the support for my children and for the future generations to come. On reserve, off reserve, Inuit, Métis, First Nations, treaty, non-treaty, however the government chooses to label us, we're not going away anytime soon. I'm going into my second decade of living with HIV. How and why I'm alive today, I cannot tell you. What I can tell you is that we have still so many more challenges ahead of us. And I am very deeply committed my life to this work. I would like to say thank you very much to each and every person who made it possible to bring us all here together today, because our stories are so important to share. It reminds us of why we're doing this work. It reminds us of what is most important. Gela Kessler. Thank you.
Friends, guests, we pride ourselves in Toronto as being a place and of welcome for voices of dissent, a place that makes room for all voices. We've been asked at this moment in the program to accommodate some groups that have messages they would like to bring. We have agreed to give each of these three groups 1 minute each. For your attention, please. First, from the Treatment Action Campaign of South Africa, Kinsane Mavasa.
I greet everyone, all protocol observed. Three things that I want to talk about. Accountability. There is a demand as civil society and all the people who are living with HIV and all organizations who are concerned on the action to put all the political leaderships accountable in order to do or to can fulfill the promises that they made. And also a call and an appeal to the scientists and research, not only to research about the statistics, but also to research about the prevention, translating it in order to make sure that the epidemic goes down. The second thing is the issue that we are demanding on is the issue of target on prevention and treatment by 2007. The third thing is the International Day of Action on Violation of Human Rights. Particularly, people who are living with HIV positive. As we can see, and as we, in rural areas, the thing that is happening is that the people who are living with HIV, their rights are being violated every day, every second, every minute. So we have a demand on the International Day of Action that whoever, everyone who will be on that day will be surviving, will make sure that there is an action to make sure that those things happened. The last thing is the issue of GIPA and women. We are talking of greater involvement of people living with HIV and AIDS, but when we look in this conference, we find that only the professionals and only the intellectuals are addressing, but we, the people who are living with HIV, are just attending to just be the number of that we are here. And the last thing is a call to support the condemnation of the management of the Delta Chelsea, who have threatened to suspend every worker who puts on a button and a red ribbon, who are supporting this International AIDS Conference. So it's a call to everyone who's listening here to make that to make sure that we condemn this, because this is the violation of human rights. Thank you.
From the Delhi Network of Positive People, Loon Gangchi.
Let me hear the voice of people living with HIV AIDS. Universal access to health is a human right. It's immoral, unacceptable, unjust, and outright genocide when the rich people can buy life, and when the poor, while the poor peoples are condemned to cruel, unnecessary, untimely, and unjust death. We demand universal and free access to all essential medicine. People before death. All the government official out here, please remember, when you sign for FTA, our life is at stake.
Thank you. From Front Aids Russia is the Ruskaya Federatsiya, Alexander Rumyantsev.
Здравствуйте. Я из России и скажу очень по-русски.
Hello, I'm from Russia and I'm going to speak in a very Russian way.
Нет капитализму. Рыночная система не способна обеспечить все возрастающую потребность к лечению.
No to capitalism. The market system is unable to give drugs to the people who need them.
Нет фармацевтическому империализму и патентам на жизнь. Они не должны решать, сколько стоит наша жизнь.
No to the imperialism of the pharmaceutical companies. They should not be deciding the price of our lives.
Активисты со стороны объединяйтесь. Они должны знать, что мы везде.
Activists from throughout the world unite. They should know that we are everywhere.
Спасибо.
Anders Nordström is a medical doctor from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. Dr. Nordström is currently the acting director general of the World Health Organization. Dr. Nordström.
Thank you. Dear colleagues, I feel very humbled to speak after engaged colleagues as we've just have heard. Time to deliver is a call for action. During the last few years, we have seen a sequence of important international political promises to address HIV/AIDS. The result is an unprecedented global commitment to work towards universal access to HIV/AIDS prevention, treatment, care and support. However, no more statements are needed. It's time to deliver on the promises that have been made. This conference has highlighted the importance of an even stronger focus on women and young people all over the world who bears the greatest burden and needs particular attention. Each of us now, as we prepare to return home, must take with us a vigorous sense of this responsibility for action. There are three key areas that I would like to talk about now in a few minutes for action and delivery. It's money, medicine, and a motivated health workforce. Let me start with the money. There has been some important progress. Worldwide, resources for HIV/AIDS increased to over $8 billion last year. But this is still far from enough. The estimated needs in low and middle income countries is $15 billion this year, growing to $22 billion in 2008. This widening gap must be filled. And commitments sustained. This is no longer only an emergency. This is, as Peter Piot said in his introductory remark, this is a long-term development agenda that we need now to focus on. It's a call for more than traditional development assistance. Innovative financing mechanisms are now emerging, such as the UNITAID, the initiative by France, Brazil, Chile, Norway and the UK, which puts a levy on airline taxes to channel new money to HIV/AIDS work. This is very much welcomed. Last month, I attended the G8 meeting in St. Petersburg, and all the G8 leaders pledged their continued financial and political support. However, we have to hold them firmly to that. We need also to work on it domestically. National governments needs to make HIV/AIDS a funding priority and sustain their commitment to health. Let me now turn to medicines. Access to drugs remains critical. 3x5 influenced the landscape and changed the thinking. This progress needs to be sustained. The tenfold increase in people on treatment in sub-Saharan Africa shows that we can do it. Sub-Saharan Africa also illustrates what still needs to be done. It represents 70% of the global unmet need for treatment. There is a growing momentum today for innovation, research, and intellectual property issues to ensure maximum access to new products that will save lives. We need ideas to turn into new drugs and diagnostics that strengthen our ability to safely treat infants and children as well as adults. We need to invest in more in developing new prevention tools, including microbicides and, of course, vaccines. Support for these needs is coming in many different directions, from many different directions. Advanced market commitments can, for example, underpin research and development of essential drugs and vaccines. The prices, the pricing. We have made some substantial progress, but much more is needed. Again, last month, I attended a meeting with the Secretary General, Kofi Annan, in New York, together with the Chief Executive Officer for some of the largest pharmaceutical companies. And I would say that we had a very concrete discussion in terms of what the factor can be done more in terms of increasing access to second-line drugs and drugs specifically targeting children. UNAIDS plays a critical role in continuing to focus the world's attention on the challenges and the Global Fund in challenging resources to where they are most needed. A special word of thanks to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for their recent grant to the Global Fund. This needs to be followed also by others, and also for their support to new technology in the area of prevention. Finally, and perhaps the most important area to ensure success in achieving universal access is in the area of skilled and motivated health workforce. I'm very happy that the conference has been now focusing on these issues. No improvements in finance or medical products can make a lasting difference to people's life until the crisis in health workforce has been solved. The situation calls for drastic measures. There are too few people with the right skills. More people registered to attend this conference than there are doctors in the Eastern and Southern Africa. The number of health workers are being diminished day by day by disease and lack of incentives. Countries with HIV/AIDS prevalence of 15% or more can expect to lose more than 30% of the healthcare workforce over the next 10-year period. It's crucial that we protect and support our health workers. WHO's Treat, Train, Retain, TTR plan, launched this week, directly addressed the needs for a healthy, skilled and motivated health workforce. The solution have to directly and bravely also tackle the underlying causes for this shortage. It's not only a matter of training. It's a matter of recognizing that health workers are being driven away by low salaries and poor working conditions. Some are forced away to other jobs, either nationally or elsewhere in the world. Of course, health workers are only one, but also the most important factor in a functional and efficient health system. There is a need also for good information and surveillance systems, logistics, distribution, and so on. To conclude, we need to scale up our response through a renewed public health approach. WHO's public health approach to HIV/AIDS is based on the principles of simplification, standardization, decentralization, equity, and patients and community participation. To carry out these principles successfully, we need to work differently. We need synergies in our response. Too many resources of time, energy, and money have been wasted on the debate over whether prevention or treatment should be the priority. At this conference, we come to a clear understanding that it is not a case of doing one or the other. Millions have died through lack of both. We have to confront and deal with both the causes and effects of HIV/AIDS. We also need, as we have heard also this morning, the synergy in our work working with each other. No one has the capacity to manage HIV/AIDS alone. Universal access demands a universal response. Think of this as a borderless society for health, one that includes everyone in the continuum of HIV/AIDS prevention, treatment, care, and support. That embraces all who can make a difference, from political leaders, scientists, health workers, to young people, people living with HIV/AIDS, the poor, sex workers, injecting drug users, men who have sex with men, people in prison. This includes NGOs, civil society, the activists that we just saw, private providers, pharmaceutical companies, community groups. And this includes not only the health sector, of course, but also education, infrastructure, finance, and other sectors. We need a strong gender perspective in our work to ensure that both women and men, girls and boys are provided equal opportunities. All of us are responsible now for the next steps as we are going back to our homes. This week, an amazing range of speakers have confronted us with some of the most persistent challenges in our time. I would finally like to pay a tribute to our late colleague and my dear friend J.W. Lee, the late Director General of WHO, who played an important part in causing a shift in approach and attitude to those challenges. He showed that we can do it. People were challenging him when he launched the 3x5, but I think we've seen that treatment is possible. Now, the most pressing of those challenges in front of us is to support every country in getting and keeping the health workforce they need. Universal access must include access to skilled and motivated health workers. It's time to deliver on money, medicine, and a motivated health workforce. I thank you.
And now it's my pleasure to introduce Stephen Lewis, whose accomplishment I can't do justice to in a very short time. Stephen Lewis is the chair of the Stephen Lewis Foundation, author of the national bestseller Race Against Time, and UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa. A lifelong social democrat and diplomat, he has focused much of his humanitarian efforts on the African continent. Mr. Lewis' career at the UN has spanned more than two decades. Please join me in welcoming Stephen Lewis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am particularly privileged to join this extraordinary panel of participants, but especially, if I may, to sit with Keisha Larkin and feel the power of the voice of Aboriginal peoples in Canada who so courageously faced the virus in such disproportionate numbers. I'm going to speak with almost supernatural rapidity, so I beg you to bear with me. This is the last speech I shall make at any of these international conferences in my role as United Nations envoy. I'm glad for obvious reasons that it comes in Toronto, but I'm equally pleased because this has been a good conference covering an extraordinary range of ground, and I therefore feel confident in asking you to join with me in giving force to the oft-repeated mantra, time to deliver. Of what would that meaning consist? Allow me to set out a number of items. Number one, abstinence-only programs do not work. Ideological rigidity almost never works when applied to the human condition. Moreover, it's an antiquated throwback to the conditionality of yesteryear to tell any government how to allocate its money for prevention. That approach has a name. It's called neocolonialism. Number two, harm reduction programs do work. Needle exchange and methadone treatment save lives. More, it would be positively perverse to close the InSight Safe Injection facility in Vancouver. when it has been positively evaluated in a number of studies. In fact, there should be several more such facilities in Canada and around the world. Russia, Central Asia, parts of India are all struggling with transmission through injecting drug use. To shut insight down is to invite HIV infection and death. One has to wonder about the minds of those who would so readily punish injecting drug users rather than understanding the problem for what it is, a matter of public health. Number three, circumcision as a preventive intervention should not be subject to bureaucratic contemplation forever. We have enough information now to know that it is an intervention worth pursuing. What remains is a single-minded effort to get the word out, respect cultural sensitivities, and then for those who want to proceed, make certain that we have well-trained personnel to perform the operations. The men are lining up for the procedure in Swaziland. And when I was in the Zambian Copperbelt just a couple of weeks ago at an animated meeting with the district commissioner, he indicated that he was part of an ethnic group which was circumcised. I then revealed that I was circumcised. And there followed a joyous frenzy of male bonding. Amongst all the circumcisees. The fact of the matter is that even in the remotest parts of Africa, there is now an awareness of the issue. It's important to act on it. Number four, the growing excitement around a microbicide is entirely warranted. This is a preventive technology whose time has come. To be sure, there can be no flagging in the dogged quest for a vaccine. But it would appear that where preventive technologies are concerned, the microbicide is first in line. Now is the time to make certain in advance that when the discovery is made, it is instantly accessible and acceptable to the women of the world, wherever they may live. Number five, in the hierarchy of preventive measures, the prevention of mother-to-child transmission is very near the top. It is a bitter indictment that so few HIV-positive pregnant women have access to PMTCT. But that's just the half of it. It is inexcusable that in Africa and other parts of the developing world, we continue to use single-dose nevirapine rather than full triple therapy. Full triple therapy during pregnancy, as we do in Western countries like Canada. This means that hundreds of thousands of babies continue to be born HIV positive, rather than reducing the transmission rate virtually to zero. I ask, what kind of a world do we live in where the life of an African child or an Asian child is worth so much less than the life of a Canadian child? Number six, it is now accepted as unassailable truth that people in treatment need nutritious food supplements to maintain and tolerate their treatment. And yet, there is a growing clamor from people living with AIDS that decent nutrition simply isn't available, leaving them in a desperate predicament. The World Food Program released a study at this conference calculating the cost of food supplementation at 66 cents a day for an entire family. What madness is it that denies the World Food Program the necessary money? Number seven. Number seven. One of the issues that received an insufficient airing at this conference is sexual violence against women. Just a few months ago, I was visiting the local hospital in Thika, Kenya, which houses the one rape counseling center in that part of the country. The rise in sexual violence has meant that there are over 30 reported cases every month, with multiples of that number never, of course, reported. In April of this year, there were 46 reported cases. 22 were under the age of 18. Half of those were under the age of 12. Horrific, you say? Without question. But how would you characterize an emerging pattern of the sexual assault of women between the ages of 65 and 80? The rapists confident that they can rape with impunity without fear of transmission. Sexual violence is everywhere reported, from marital rape to rape as a war crime. The phenomenon is by no means singularly African. We live in a world community where the depravity of sexual violence has run amok. In Africa, however, the violence and the virus go together. And yet we lack the laws, the jurisprudence, the enforcement that would give to women even a modicum of protection. If ever there was a cause to mobilize AIDS activists around the world, this is it. Number 8. We urgently need a resolution of the vaccine debate over testing and counseling. We made progress at this conference, but by no means definitive progress. It seems to me that the growing embrace of routine testing and counseling with an opt-out provision to protect human rights is the appropriate emerging consensus. Everyone should keep an eye on Lesotho, where the Know Your Status campaign will, I believe, become the benchmark, pro or con, for the continent and beyond. Number 9. There is an ongoing epidemic of child sexual abuse. The dynamic of abuse of children is often different from that of the sexual abuse of women. What is common to both is the terrifying danger of transmission. Children require different interventions. Alas, we are nowhere near the articulation of a response. In this instance, as in every such instance, children are relegated to the scrap heap of society's priorities, and have been so relegated throughout the 25 years of this pandemic. Number 10. It is impossible to talk about children without talking about orphans. And it is impossible to understand how, in the year 2006, we still continue to fail to implement policies to address the torrent, the deluge of orphan children. Countries have programs of action. They languish, unfunded. One of the most chilling pieces of statistical data is the finding that only 3 to 5% of orphans receive any intervention of any kind from the state. The monumental numbers of orphans, so many of them now adults because the pandemic has gone on for so long, pose a bracing, almost insuperable challenge for the countries which they inhabit. I appeal to everyone to recognize that we're walking on the knife's edge of an unsolvable human catastrophe. Inevitably, we're preoccupied with the here and now. But the cumulative impact of these orphan kids, their levels of trauma, their overwhelming personal needs, their intense collective vulnerability strikes at the heart of the human dynamic, creating a sociological rearrangement of human relationships. And we're doing so little about it. Our response is microscopic. We are inviting the whirlwind, and we will not be able to cope. Number 11. It is impossible to talk about orphans without talking about grandmothers. Who would ever have imagined it would come to this? In Africa, the grandmothers are the unsung heroes of the continent. These extraordinary, resilient, courageous women, fighting through the inconsolable grief of the loss of their own adult children, becoming parents again in their 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s. I attended a grandmother's gathering last weekend on the eve of the conference. The grandmothers were magnificent, but they're all struggling with the same anguished nightmare. What happens to my grandchildren when I die? We need major social welfare programs that will recognize these essential caregivers' contributions to society. As legitimate and difficult labor and offer the guarantee of sustainable incomes to the grandmothers of Africa. From food to school fees to income generation, the answers must be found. It's another test for the delegates to this conference. Number 12, and I align myself with my colleague Anders. In the midst of everything else, we must continue to roll out treatment. I am worried by the new figures. There were 1,300,000 people in treatment at the end of 2005. 6 months later, there are 1,650,000 in treatment. The additional 350,000 seems a very modest increment. Treatment is keeping people alive. Treatment is bringing hope. Treatment is stimulating prevention. Treatment is meshing more and more frequently with community-based care. We cannot let the process slow. Number 13. Number 13, and while I'm on the issue of treatment, I am bound to raise South Africa. South Africa is the unkindest cut of all. It is the only country in Africa, amongst all the countries I have traversed in the last 5 years, whose government is still obtuse, dilatory, and negligent about rolling out treatment. It is the only country in Africa whose government continues to propound theories more worthy of a lunatic fringe than of a concerned and compassionate state. Between 600 and 800 people a day die of AIDS in South Africa. The government has a lot to atone for. I'm of the opinion that they can never achieve redemption. There are those who will say I have no right, as a United Nations official, to say such things of a member state. I was appointed as envoy on AIDS in Africa. I see my job as advocating for those who are living with the virus, those who are dying of the virus, all of those. All of those in and out of civil society who are fighting the good fight to achieve social justice, it is not my job to be silenced by a government when I know that what it is doing is wrong, immoral, indefensible. This morning, Zaki Ahmed, the head of the Treatment Action Campaign, and 44 of his colleagues demonstrating against a particular death from AIDS which should never have taken place, were arrested in South Africa, I presume charged, and then released. It really is distressing when the coercive apparatus of the state is brought against the most principled members of society. Number 14. Unbeknownst to many, we are on the cusp of a huge financial crisis in response to the pandemic. I think we have been lulled into a damaging false security by the fact that we jumped from roughly $300 million a year from all sources in the late 1990s to $8.3 billion in 2005. And indeed, it sounds impressive. But we need $15 billion this year, and $18 billion next year, and $22 billion in 2008. Any straight-line projection will take us to $30 billion in 2010, the moment of universal access to treatment, prevention, and care. We're billions and billions of dollars short of those targets. If these circumstances continue, universal access is doomed. All governments, as they continue to expand their treatment and prevention initiatives, are spooked by worries of financial sustainability. They're right to be spooked. The financial promises made at the G8 summit in Gleneagles 1 year ago are already unraveling. We will never accumulate the extra $25 billion for Africa by 2010, as was committed. PEPFAR has not yet announced its extension beyond 2008. When it does, as it surely will, the annual contribution given the other demands on the U.S. Treasury will probably remain at $3 billion a year. That large amount was a very significant percentage of the total expenditure on AIDS back in 2003-2004, but as a percentage of what is needed for global AIDS programs in 2008, $22 billion, $3 billion seems pretty paltry from the world's superpower. I'm going to do something profoundly and disconcertingly unorthodox. You have occasionally interrupted with ripples of applause. The screen in front of me says your time has run out. Please sum up. I have two or three other things I'd like to say. Do I have your collective permission to say them? The Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria is still $500 million short this year and more than $1 billion short next year. At the moment, there is no obvious way to close the shortfall. It is almost inconceivable that the extravagant promises of Gleneagles are revealed as so fatuous that the Global Fund is now compromised. No one is asking for any more than that which was promised, but the Pavlovian betrayal of the South has already begun. Everything in the battle against AIDS is put at risk by the behavior of the G8. Yesterday, Dr. Julio Montaner courageously characterized that behavior as genocide. I remember back in 2001, in an op-ed for the Globe and Mail, I used the phrase mass murder. It's hard, in the face of the annihilating human toll, not to be driven to linguistic extremes. This issue of resources makes or breaks the response to the pandemic. It is imperative that the delegates here assembled never let the G8 countries off the hook. I had a section on capacity, which I wanted to disgorge, but it resembles what Andre said, so I shall move on to the final elements. What has to happen, I think, is that we place a temporary moratorium on the endless self-indulgent proliferation of meetings, seminars, roundtables, discussion groups, task forces, ad nauseam, plus the production of reports, documents, monographs, statistical data, ad repetition, and concentrate every energy at country level. At the opening of this conference, Peter Piot talked of the next 25 years. He's right to do so. He indicated it would be a long and difficult haul. He's right again. But if the next 25 years are to take advantage of the guarded optimism of this conference, if the next 25 years are to overcome the lethargy and inertia of the last 25 years, if the next 25 years are to link inseparably poverty and disease and the Millennium Development Goals, then it has to happen in country, on the ground, organized and orchestrated by the countries themselves and the agencies on the ground, whether multilateral, bilateral, or civil society, must be held accountable. That's what's been missing. That's the job of the delegates to this conference, holding people and organizations accountable. This 16th International AIDS Conference, beyond any preceding conference, has given voice to youth. But it's still a limited and marginalized voice, reflecting the hostile ambiguity of the adult world. The figures are brutal and stark. Fully 50% of new infections between the ages of 15 and 24. And yet, who can deny the appalling absence of programs for and engagement of young people in the fight against the pandemic? The situation cries out for redress, and it must be redressed well beyond smarmy tokenism. finally, in my view, as delegates doubtless know, the most vexing and intolerable dimension of the pandemic is what is happening to women. It's the one area of HIV and AIDS which leaves me feeling most helpless and most enraged. Gender inequality is driving the pandemic, and we will never subdue the gruesome force of AIDS until the rights of women become paramount in the struggle. Last Monday morning at the Women's March, the signs read, "Women's rights are human rights." That was the slogan that captured the Vienna International Conference on Human Rights in 1993. It was the slogan repeated at the Cairo Conference on Population in 1994, and yet again at Beijing in 1995. It's never been made real. And so long as men control the levers and bastions of power, it never will be real. Whether it's the apparatus of the United Nations, including the agencies, or the endless number of high-level panels or auspicious studies of human development like the Blair Commission on Africa, the demeaning diminution of women is everywhere evident. And those examples are but proxies for the wider world, particularly the developing world, where freedom from sexual violence, the right to sexual autonomy, to sexual and reproductive health, social and economic independence, and even the whiff of gender equality are barely approximated. It's a ghastly, deadly business, this untrammeled oppression of women in so many countries on the planet. My closest colleagues and I have come to the conclusion that one of the ways to diminish the impact of the AIDS virus is by creating a powerful international agency for women, funded and staffed to the teeth. There must be voice and advocacy and operational capacity on the ground for 52% of the world's population. There is a UN reform panel at the moment contemplating the creation of a new entity, provided they have the courage to confront the warped and abysmal gender architecture of the United Nations. If they find the courage, I deeply believe that we could begin to still the carnage. And what works for AIDS can work everywhere. I challenge you, my fellow delegates, to enter the fray against gender inequality. There is no more honorable and productive calling. There is nothing of greater import in this world. All roads lead from women to social change, and that includes subduing the pandemic. For my own part, when I leave the post of envoy at the end of the year, I have asked that my successor be an African, but most important, an African woman. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Stephen Lewis. You are such an enormous source of pride to us in Canada. Thank you. And that is why men who have sex with men and everyone else support Louise Binder's right to finish her speech in her plenary. It's my pleasure now to introduce Dr. Pedro Kahn, who is the president of the Fundación Huésped, one of the major Argentinian AIDS organizations, which he co-founded in 1998. Fundación Huésped works in the areas of clinical research, prevention, and direct services for people living with HIV/AIDS. At the end of this conference, Dr. Kahn will be the next president of the International AIDS Society. Dr. Pedro Kahn.
Delegates, distinguished guests, I am delighted to provide some closing remarks as the incoming president of the International AIDS Society. First, I would like to thank all of you, the delegates who came from every corner of the world, for making this conference such an amazing success. This has been the largest international AIDS conference in history, with more than 21,000 delegates and over 5,000 other people participating, including staff, volunteers, and exhibitors. We are also proud that almost 2,000 delegates from 133 countries received scholarships to support their participation. It is the largest and most diverse international meeting devoted to a global health issue. I think the interest in this conference is a testament to how important it is in sharing our knowledge, our experience, our successes, and also learning from our failures as we move forward. I also want to thank the co-organizers of the International AIDS Conference for their hard work and dedication, the International Council of AIDS Service Organization, the International Community of Women Living with HIV, the Global Network of People Living with HIV. The IIS is strongly committed to the GIPA principle, and this conference is an indisputable testimony of that commitment. I would like to express my gratitude also to UNAIDS, to the Canadian AIDS Society, and especially to the Toronto local host organization and the governing council, as well as the staff of the IIS. And of course, to the thousands of volunteers, including program committee members, that have worked tirelessly to ensure an unparalleled conference program that addresses the epidemic in all its complexities. I would like also to congratulate the two co-chairs of this meeting, Helen Gale and Mark Weinberg, for their outstanding leadership. I know that the quality of science here has never been stronger. Over the past 6 days, we have learned about the promise of new prevention technologies, including research into microbicides and other female control prevention tools, pre-exposure prophylaxis, the desperate need for harm reduction approaches, and also the collaborative research for finding an effective and preventive vaccine. More than ever, we confirmed during this week that prevention and care are two faces of the same coin. More than ever, biomedical and behavioral scientists have the challenge and the opportunity to work together with people living with HIV and community organizations towards our common goals. Of course, all the knowledge, the innovative research, the new tools will not be effective without the political leadership that is essential to halting this disease. We must keep the pressure on the GH leaders to follow on their commitment to achieve universal access to prevention, care and treatment by 2010. We are still far from the $22 billion per year that will be required by 2008 to achieve that goal. And we must, as the theme of the conference reminds us, tell them that now is the time to deliver on that commitment. Again, allow me to raise very loudly the voice of IIS. We will not endorse any type of Schindler's List by accepting that while those included save their lives, others are just left behind, suffering and dying. Let's be perfectly clear. Our failures have dramatic consequences. Thousands of children, men and women, are dying every day. they bear tragic testimony of our incapacity to transform words into action. We know what has to be done. The choice before the international community is clear. Either it is time to deliver or continue fueling the tragedy. Equally important in the response to HIV is our commitment to human rights of population most vulnerable to HIV/AIDS. The Youngest Review in New York highlighted that we still have a long way to go in this regard. How is it possible to mount an effective response to HIV if we cannot name the most affected communities? The right of sex trade workers, injecting drugs users, men that have sex with men and other vulnerable groups must be protected through legal and policy reform in every country around the world. The epidemic has always struck hardest at marginalized and vulnerable populations. Again, allow me to be clear. Poverty is the driving force of this and other epidemics, like TB and malaria. It is hard to advocate for human rights without considering that two-thirds of the world population live on less than $2 a day. On this, too, it is time to deliver. There has been also much discussion about how to solve the problem of the desperate shortage of healthcare workers in the developing world. Too often, healthcare workers are poorly paid or working in unsafe or dangerous conditions. Add to this the stigma attached to HIV, and the challenge for those in the front lines of the response are amplified. Whether it is a community health worker in Malawi, a nurse in Bolivia, or an HIV educator in India, we must work harder to ensure safe working environments, access to treatment and care, and appropriate pay for people we depend on to save lives, prevent infections, and improve the lives of people living with HIV. International medical graduates constitute about 25% of physicians in the US, Canada, Australia, and the UK. More than half of those are supplied by lower income countries. And in some countries, on top, death is depleting the ranks of healthcare workers more rapidly than the recruitment abroad. So we must find innovative ways to stop the hemorrhage of trained healthcare workers from the south to the north, as well as HIV-associated mortality in the healthcare sector if we are to make progress against the disease. IIS will make this a priority issue in its advocacy over the coming months. IIS is now a mature organization. Our infrastructure has evolved. Our highly skilled staff is not only essential to move forward the society day by day, but also to keep our institutional memory. I want to thank the Governing Council of IIS for this opportunity to serve our membership, which has grown to over 11,000 people working in HIV/AIDS at every level of the response. As the first IIS president from a developing country, I hope to offer a new perspective on these issues as we continue to work together. In particular, I would like to ask all stakeholders not to forget that the region where I come from, Latin America, is also suffering the consequences of the AIDS epidemic in the context of poverty and marginalization. The 2 million people living with HIV/AIDS in this region must not be excluded from our agenda. I and the other members of the Governing Council are strongly committed to preventing and treating HIV/AIDS. Together, we can mitigate suffering and curb the epidemic. Again, it is time to deliver. Thank you. I look forward to seeing you in Mexico City in 2008. Have a safe journey home. Nos vemos en México. Thank you very much. And now it's my pleasure to introduce the co-chair of the next International AIDS Conference in Mexico, my friend Luis Soto Ramírez. Luis Soto is the head of Molecular Virology Unit at the Department of Infectious Disease at the Instituto Nacional de la Nutrición in Mexico. He received his medical degree in 1982, he's a rather old guy, from the Escuela Mexicana de Medicina, and completed training and internal medicine and he has a curriculum that I cannot read because it's too large. Believe me, he's the right guy to be the co-chair. He has served as a member of the Governing Council since 2000, and he is the regional rep for Latin America and the Caribbean at our governing council. Luis, the conference is yours.
Friends, amigos, delegates and distinguished guests, it gives me great pleasure to invite you all to the 17th International AIDS Conference in Mexico City in 2008, the very first time a Latin American country will host the world's largest and most influential gathering on HIV/AIDS. The International AIDS Society and its partners, UNAIDS, ICASO, ICW, and GMP Plus, will be working closely to build a strong conference program for AIDS 2008 that responds to where the epidemic is and that highlights the tools needed to prevent it. Soon we will announce the two new community partners who will help us to plan the program for AIDS 2008. One will be an international NGO with a strong history of work in HIV/AIDS, and the other will be an HIV/AIDS organization from the Global South. In changing how we organize this conference, the International AIDS Society and its partners recognize that we need more representation from areas of the world, including Latin America, where the epidemic is most entrenched, to help us focus our agenda. Our new partners, like all our other co-organizers, must also be committed, in action as well as words, to strengthening the involvement of people living with HIV/AIDS within their organizations and in developing the conference program. Without that involvement, we cannot hope to turn the page on the greatest humanitarian catastrophe in history. It is not coincident that this conference will be held in Mexico. Latin America is faced with many challenges in its response to HIV, an urgent need for prevention, lack of infrastructure to ensure access to antiretrovirals in some regions, as in Africa, as in Asia, and the consequence of antiretroviral treatments as seen in developed countries. Moreover, migration, stigma, as well as human rights are issues not completely solved in our region. According to the World Health Organization, 68% of those in care in Latin America have access to antiretrovirals. But that number does not take in account the huge number of people that are already infected, have no idea that they are HIV positives. But numbers are just cold figures. We will talk at AIDS 2008 about human beings, each of whose life, as Melinda Gates reminded us at the opening ceremony, are of equal value, whether you are gay or straight, sex trade worker or a stay-at-home mom, black or white, mestizo or native, rich or poor, young or not so young. A long time ago, Mary Fisher reminded us that we have better get over our prejudices, because the only thing that this virus asks is, are you human? As the International AIDS Society Governing Council Regional Representative for Latin America and the Caribbean, I want to thank the government of Mexico, and particularly Minister Julio Frank, for their support to this conference. We are looking forward to work with our co-organizers to bring the best science, the most committed leaders and dedicated community groups for every corner of the globe, from every corner of Latin America to Mexico City in 2008. I hope all of you will be there. Finally, let me be very clear. We will not forget, as Richard Gere did in his hellos at the opening ceremony, Latin America. Hello, Latin America.
Hello, Mexico! Viva Mexico! Thank you. Merci beaucoup. Muchas gracias. Let me introduce the next speaker. The most important reform in the Mexican healthcare system in the last 50 years was designed and implemented by a Mexican doctor and former WHO official with a vision of how world healthcare system should be. The passion and dedication of Minister Frank for the cause of health, the fight against HIV/AIDS, and to head the battle against stigma and discrimination has been one of the important reasons why the International AIDS Society turned its face to Mexico as the idea setting for this 2008 International Conference. It is an honor for me to introduce the Mexican Minister of Health, Dr. Julio Frank Mora.
Buenas tardes, good afternoon, bonjour et merci à Canada. Dear delegates, national representatives, leaders, professionals, scientists, activists, women, men, youth, persons living with HIV/AIDS, people from diversity. In Mexico, we have spent 6 years preparing ourselves to host the International AIDS Conference. Now we know that we have a hard act to follow after the splendid organization by Toronto. How does a developing country prepare itself for an event of this magnitude? It prepares by changing to improve itself. It prepares by reforming its healthcare system, as Mexico has done, so that it assures universal access to comprehensive care, including antiretroviral therapy. This we have achieved in Mexico by providing health insurance to all people living with HIV, so that we may take care of their health needs and those of their families. It is not just access to drugs, it's access to life. A developing country prepares itself by emphasizing prevention based on scientific evidence and focused on what really works. It prepares by increasing its AIDS budget 14 times for treatment and prevention. It prepares by launching an open battle to fight stigma, discrimination, violence against women, and homophobia. Always guided by an approach based on human rights. It prepares, as Mexico has done, by amending its constitution and passing new laws to prevent and punish discrimination. It prepares by involving civil society in all important policy decisions regarding AIDS, which are now made jointly with professionals, activists, and people living with HIV, many of whom are here with me today. A developing country like Mexico prepares itself to host the International AIDS Conference by being inclusive, by welcoming everyone, by making sure that no one living with HIV nor anyone whose appearance differs from the others is subject to any restriction in order to enter our country. On behalf of Mexico, I thank the International AIDS Society for having selected us as your next host. We will live up to your trust, working with all of you. We will make sure that the voices of youth, of women, of MSM, of commercial sex workers, of intravenous drug users, of migrants, of indigenous populations, of all people living with AIDS and caring about them are heard loud and clear in Mexico. We will do our very best to have a great program of quality sessions, to create an environment where we can all learn from each other, to make you feel positive about the great work you are carrying out. So, you see, we have been preparing ourselves by changing to improve. And we are now fully prepared to welcome you to Mexico, welcome you to Latin America, where we always say, mi casa es tu casa. My home is your home. Thank you. Merci beaucoup. Hasta la vista.
It's time now for us to hand over the Toronto Conference to our Mexican friends and colleagues. And I would like to say before doing so that it has been a great, great honor for so many of us who are, like me, members of civil society and non-governmental organization, members of community here in Canada, to have worked on this conference. And it has been of enormous benefit, I think, to us as civil society. And it's my fervent hope that as the conference travels now to Mexico and further abroad, that these conferences will continue to serve as an opportunity to enhance the role of community. Thank you. Joining us for the handover is Helena Georges, who was first elected to the House of Commons as Conservative Party of Canada, member of Simcoe Gray. She is currently the Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of International Trade, as well as our esteemed Mayor of the City of Toronto, Mayor David Miller.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you can all hear me. Now, ladies and gentlemen, as the co-chair of the 16th International Conference on AIDS, it is my great honor and duty to announce that Mexico City will host the next international conference in the year 2008. And I now turn our emblematic globe over to its co-chair, Dr. Luis Soto Ramirez, a good friend and a wonderful scientist who will assume the distinction of co-chairing that conference.
We will wait for all of you in Mexico. You won't forget that experience. Okay? And now we will have the chance to see why Mexico continuously joys for life.
Come, follow me. Welcome to another world. A land full of wonders, contrasts, and myths. Welcome to Tenochtitlan, home of the Mexicas. Don't be afraid. Contrary to what most people think, there's a lot more than blood sacrifices. There was once a deity, half human, half myth, who was worshipped by the name of Quetzalcoatl, serpent of precious feathers, which symbolizes the duality of life and death, earth and sky, and everything that is good and wise. Quetzalcoatl never admitted sacrifices of the blood of humans nor of animals, but rather only of bread and roses, flowers and perfumes, and of incense. Also, he watched and prevented with much efficacy that which was harmful to any human being. Quetzalcoatl truly believed that only through respect, care, and compassion could human beings become divine beings. Welcome to Mexico City, site of spectacular infrastructure, amazing sights, and diversity of open-hearted people.
We have been chosen as the first country in Latin America to host the 17th International AIDS Conference, which will be held from the 3rd to the 8th of August in 2008. Mexico is a laic state that supports science, believes in sexual and reproductive rights, and the use of condoms. Our country would never deny entry to any who carry HIV/AIDS. We have successfully submitted some initiatives in order to modify our constitution, thus creating a federal law against discrimination. Also, with the valuable contribution of NGOs, we have accomplished major achievements such as a prevention program to eradicate virus transmission through blood transfusion and universal access to antiretrovirals. We have managed to develop and broadcast social awareness campaigns against stigmatization, discrimination, and homophobia on a national level. And we're currently launching a major campaign with different strategies aimed to reach diverse profiles such as teenagers, parents, teachers, the gay community, transgenders, sex workers, people living with the virus, and society in general.
We still have some things to do. Empower women, diminish machismo, decrease inequity, improve ARV procurement, start a broad sexuality education program.
We have come a long way. Now we're paving the road to reach more people, spreading more and better information in each and every federal state. And we will continue to go for the extra mile. In recent years, Mexico has been changing. Now we have universal access to antiretrovirals. Now, all our HIV sexual transmission prevention policies are fully informed and based on scientific evidence. But above all, our main strategy is to continuously promote the use of condoms. Now we have a constitutional amendment to fight discrimination. Now, all our national AIDS policies are planned jointly with civil society and people living with HIV. Now we have a health reform that provides health insurance to all people living with HIV. Now Mexico is fully prepared to welcome you to the 17th International AIDS Conference in 2008.
Now we have a surprise for you, Eugenia León. Eugenia is one of the most important singers in Mexico, with 30 years of professional career and 22 records. Most importantly, Eugenia has been committed with social issues and human rights since the 80s, and engaged since then in the fight against AIDS. I want to thank Eugenia for coming here to represent the Mexican joy for life. Ladies and gentlemen, Eugenia León.
Okay.
Que no somos iguales. Dice la gente. Que tu vida y mi vida se van a perder. Que yo soy un canalla. Y que tú eres decente, que dos seres distintos no se pueden querer, pero yo ya te quise y no te olvido, y morir en tus brazos es mi ilusión. Yo no entiendo esas cosas de las clases sociales. Solo sé que me quieres y que te quiero yo. Dice la gente.